Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. And today I'm excited to bring to you a podcast episode on the subject of cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, otherwise known as CTCL. This podcast has been developed in collaboration with Kiowa Kirin and will discuss findings from the recent European Hematology Association 2021 Congress. Joining me from Manchester in the United Kingdom is a true expert in the field, Professor Richard Cowan, consultant in clinical oncology and director of the Christie School of Oncology. Richard sits on the National NCRI Lymphoma Clinical Studies Group, the International EORTC Cutaneous Lymphoma Scientific Committee, and the EORTC Radiation Oncology Study Group Committees, and is also the external examiner for the Royal Marsden Institute of Cancer Research Master's Course in Oncology. The good professor's also involved in working with colleagues in low-middle-income countries in oncology and is the chair of the newly formed United Kingdom Global Cancer Network and sits on the steering group of the United Kingdom's Kenyan and Ugandan Health Alliances. Richard's the director of the Christie International School of Oncology, delivering courses in Kolkata, Chennai, Penang, and Cairo. They also run an extensive international fellowship program for cancer specialists from all around the world. And additionally, Dr. Cowan is the external examiner for the Postgraduate Institute in Sri Lanka for their national examination in oncology. So I think you would concur that our guest today is highly qualified to help us navigate this topic. We're looking to cover a wide range of subjects relating to CTCL, including diagnosis, quality of life, currently available treatments, as well as crucial unmet needs. So let's get straight into it. Richard, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're delighted to have you, and especially when I tell you something just as a kickoff, because I want to state for the record that at medical school, dermatology was a struggle for me. In fact, I failed first time and I had to take remedial dermatology over the summer. So I want to start with something basic. My understanding is that cutaneous T-cell lymphomas can present most commonly in two forms, mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome. Is that correct, first of all?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And just to say that mycosis fungoides is by far the more common type of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, probably two-thirds of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, mycosis fungoides. Sézary syndrome is much rarer, only 5 or 10% of cutaneous lymphoma present as Sézary syndrome. And the two diseases, as we'll discuss shortly, manifest in rather different ways.
Well, I'll tell you what, using me as a basis, can you describe the similarities and differences between mycosis and Sézary syndrome?
Well, the reason we categorise them together, Jonathan, is because they are both malignant conditions involving the collection of malignant T lymphocytes into the surface of the skin. So these are trafficking lymphocytes which have congregated in the skin in a proliferation which can manifest in one of two ways. In mycosis fungoides, it characteristically causes a rash. And this is an erythematous patch, which by definition a patch means it's impalpable, or a raised plaque that you can feel. And then as the disease progresses, it can actually form tumours. Sézary syndrome, on the other hand, causes what we describe as erythroderma, which means the whole surface of the skin becomes inflamed and red. L'homme rouge is a very classic characteristic description of patients with Sézary syndrome.
Can you spell that? L'homme rouge?
So, yeah, so the red man, so L apostrophe H-O-M-M-E.
Oh, l'homme rouge, I see, the red man.
Sorry, it's my poor French pronunciation, I apologise.
Yeah, well, I was garbage at French as well, so I'm with you there. So the red man, so in other presentations, I actually saw a case I was seeing a patient for, I believe it was gallstones, and noticed that they had a strange rash, and had to call one of my dermatology colleagues because I was completely clueless. But this patient also had alopecia relating to it, had complained actually that their hair was falling out. So is that a common manifestation?
Well, it is a characteristic manifestation, Jonathan, I'd say, in that what can happen is as the infiltration of the malignant lymphocytes in mycosis fungoides goes into the hair follicles, it disrupts the production of hair. So you can get patches of loss of hair. And that can be quite subtle. And I think as we'll come to discuss a little bit later, to actually make a diagnosis of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, be it mycosis fungoides or Sézary syndrome, can be very difficult. And sometimes it's these rather subtle changes that you can see in the skin that can actually trigger your suspicion that this could be the condition. And so it does require a very experienced dermatologist or dermato-oncologist to be examining the patients and noticing these more subtle changes.
Actually, it's a timely comment. I was going to ask you, how does one confirm or refute the diagnosis? And also, before you answer that, how common is this? Or how rare is this, I should say?
Okay, it's a rare condition. We talk about in the UK an annual incidence of about 1 per 100,000. So that would equate to 600 or 700 new patients a year in the UK. In our region of about 3.2 million, we see 30 to 50 patients, new patients a year. But we have patients referred from further afield as well.
Right. And to confirm the diagnosis, what does one do? Because there's lots of rashes, right?
Well, what patients develop is an erythematous rash. Now, what do you do in those circumstances? Well, many cases, people might not do very much at all if it's mild. And maybe I can share a gender-specific comment, which is some people might say is unjustified. But it is more common in men, and my experience is that men probably are less enthusiastic to rush to the doctor if they have a slight red patch on their skin. So men who develop a red area might well just watch it for a while without doing anything. And they might be picked up incidentally when they're seeing the GP about something else, or they might be prompted by a partner to go to have it seen. And when the GP sees it, because it's quite non-specific, inevitably the general practitioner will think of the more common skin conditions. So is this eczema? Is it psoriasis? Is it a fungal infection? Those are the sort of more common conditions which look quite similar. And so quite often patients are actually treated for those conditions for quite a period of time. And there is some pretty good data we produced in recent years to show that on average, people could wait 5, even 7 years before a diagnosis is made of cutaneous lymphoma. So when patients come to us, when we ask them, when do you think you first noticed a spot or a rash on the skin, they might say it was 5 or 7 years ago. And sometimes, you know, I've seen patients who've had something for 20, 25 years, which actually has never been diagnosed. So that sort of sets the scene. And I suppose it tells us two things. One, how difficult it can be to diagnose. But two, also, it can run a very indolent path where it changes very little over time.
So you've mentioned that this can run a pretty indolent course, CTC Health. Tell us a little bit about the quality of life. I mean, a red patch on your skin may not be a great deal, but what are the other ways that CTCL can impact quality of life?
Okay, so it can spread further beyond the initial area. And one point, which is a very important point to make, is one of the good treatments for cutaneous lymphoma is sunlight. And although we tell our patients to protect themselves from the sun for most skin cancers, cutaneous lymphoma is an exception. And the reason I'm just mentioning that is that cutaneous lymphoma usually presents in areas of the body which are not so sun exposed. So they're covered. So therefore, people don't notice them very much. But it's when they start itching, when it starts to spread into areas which are more exposed. So if it gets to their face or their arms, areas which where it can be seen, so there's a cosmetic effect. And then, unfortunately, as the disease progresses, the skin can start to break down and become tumours, and in very advanced stages, patients require dressing. You were asking me, Jonathan, about the difference between Sézary and mycosis fungoides. In Sézary syndrome, where we have redness throughout the skin, the symptoms there are itch. And I'm afraid we are very, very poor at being able to manage the itch in patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma with Sézary syndrome. And there's a classic situation in the waiting room at my clinics where you'll see, unfortunately, patients sitting in their chair and literally writhing and rubbing up against the back of the seat and constantly scratching, because it can be an persistent and, using the words that our patients use, unbearable itch. So an itch is probably one of the most debilitating symptoms that they can get. With Sézary syndrome, there's a sort of a triad of a number of symptoms. So I've mentioned the itch. The second is flaking of the skin. So every time they move or every time they take their clothes off, there's just a shower, a snowstorm of skin, and either the patient or the patient's partner who they live with just tell you that they're constantly hoovering up all this skin that is shedding. The third characteristic, which is causing distress, is, as we know, the skin is a very important thermoregulator, and we use our skin to help us control our temperature. And when you've got Sézary syndrome, you can imagine this red, inflamed surface to your skin, and if you touch it, it's warm. So the patient feels warm, and of course they're like a radiator. They're just radiating heat from this skin, and their core temperature is dropping. And so in a room, the characteristic thing they will say is that I'm in a room and someone's just got shirt sleeves on and I'm putting my down jacket on, I'm putting a jumper on, I feel cold when everyone else feels warm. And they can't get warm due to this excess loss of heat. So those are some of the most distressing symptoms of Sézary syndrome. With mycosis fungoides, I mentioned it can start as a mild patch, it can then thicken to a plaque, and then unfortunately it can become tumours and ulcerating. And we do have patients who can have multiple dressings over different areas of their body where the skin has broken down. And of course, once you've got open wounds, it gets infected and people are very susceptible to infection. So there's a whole sort of spectrum of symptomatology that can bring this to light. And sometimes it is only when the symptoms become quite distressing does the diagnosis actually made. And maybe we should just mention a little bit about the pathway, because I think you're asking me about the pathway to the diagnosis. And once a rash, which we thought was a common condition such as eczema or psoriasis, is not responding, the patient is usually referred from the general practitioner to a dermatologist. The dermatologist may or may not identify it as mycosis fungoides by virtue of the varying presentations of this condition. And it's only when you carry out a skin biopsy, so taking a little sample of skin and looking at it under the microscope, are we getting in a position to make the diagnosis? But it's not even as easy as that. We can't just look down the microscope and say that is cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, Sézary or mycosis fungoides, because infiltration of lymphocytes into the skin can occur for many conditions, including inflammatory conditions. And so We always say to make a diagnosis of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, you need a clinico-pathological diagnosis. And by that I mean that an experienced clinician needs to look at the skin, examine the skin carefully, and look for the clinical features of mycosis fungoides. They then look under the microscope, and there are characteristic features under the microscope, but they are not completely diagnostic on their own. And only when you put the clinical picture and the histological appearance together can you make a diagnosis. And what this means is that patients really need to be referred to a specialist centre where there is a histopathologist with or a team of histopathologists who are highly experienced in dermatopathology and hematopathology, such that they can identify cutaneous T-cell lymphoma and distinguish it from the nuances of other inflammatory conditions. And just by way of example, if you get a nasty insect bite and it gets quite inflamed, if we took a biopsy at that moment of maximum inflammation, it would look very unpleasant under the microscope. There'd be a lot of unpleasant, large inflammatory lymphocytes, and it is very difficult to distinguish between those and malignant ones. And so we always recommend it is a clinico-pathological diagnosis by a specialist multidisciplinary team. And in fact, we have a multidisciplinary team meeting where we all get into a sort of darkened room. Those of us who've actually seen the patient make a description of the clinical appearance in the skin. We always ask our patients if we can take photographs of the skin so that other dermatologists who are part of the team who haven't seen the patient can see the clinical photographs. And then we look down the microscope. And at that point, we hopefully can make the diagnosis. And when I say hopefully, we still have situations where we have to speak to the patient and say, your condition is suspicious of, but we can't firmly make a diagnosis, and we're going to keep you under review. Some of those patients, it all settles down and nothing further happens, but others do develop into cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. And so this situation of a suspicious patient requiring onward monitoring is very important. But put yourself into the patient's position, they're told they might have a skin cancer, and so you go and see the specialist, and then when the specialists say, I'm not sure, that is very unsettling for the patient. And so there is the psychological side of this that we also have to be very cognizant of.
Thank you for that, Richard. First of all, I'm enthralled, and I wish you'd been teaching dermatology back when I was at medical school, but I think we're the same vintage, so that would have been a struggle. You've mentioned the characteristics of the disease and the quality of life, and I've come to learn that pruritus, itchiness, is a wretched symptom. It really is. And, you know, we've all had a period of time where we've had itchy skin from a mosquito bite or nettles or whatever it might be. And so to imagine living with that chronically must be absolutely awful. So let's consider the quality of life for those patients and their carers as well, or their partners, when they start to receive an effective treatment. What's the impact like?
Well, I suppose, Jonathan, it depends at which point we are intervening, because, again, just to set the scene, we divide cutaneous T-cell lymphoma into early stage and late stage disease. And the early stage disease are those patients who've just got a few patches and plaques. It's not causing great distress, and we can give them a fairly mild treatment. Those with advanced disease are those with Sézary syndrome and those who've got tumours in the skin who need much more aggressive treatment. If we talk about the patients with early stage disease, at the first intervention we would consider simply some topical steroid creams just to apply onto the inflamed area, which can quieten it down and bring about relief quite simply. If, as is often the case, the mycosis fungoides becomes extensive, covering much of the body, then, as you can imagine, from a practical point of view, applying cream to numerous areas of patches and plaques on different parts of your body is not straightforward. And at that point, is when we recommend phototherapy, where the patient goes into a light chamber and receives pulses of light therapy, like a sunbed sort of thing, probably two or three times a week for a period of a number of weeks. And that can clear the skin extremely well. So the patient notices the cosmetic improvement and the improvement in itch and dryness and irritation that the skin was causing before. If we go on to more advanced disease, here patients are suffering. They could be having dressings on numerous areas of their body. They could be losing weight and generally feeling unwell. And at that point, we need to be administering more significant drug treatments. And there are a whole variety of drug treatments that can be given. Some of the drug treatments work quite slowly, and therefore you are relieving the distress at a painfully slow rate for the patients. And we have that rather the difficulty that they come back a few weeks later. Is it better? Is it not? And you're not too sure, and the patient's not too sure. But because we've only got a limited number of weapons against this condition, we want to make sure that when we introduce a treatment, that we don't discard it too early when it might have had value if you wait a little bit longer. So some of the drug treatments that we use, we do have to monitor the patient very carefully. And we do that by obviously their symptoms, and we ask the patients exactly how they're feeling. And in Manchester, we've recently developed an electronic patient recorded outcome platform, whereby a week before they come, we ask them a series of questions about the symptoms that their disease is giving the patient, and that is automatically downloaded to us. So before we see the patient, we can see how much distress, how much pain, how much itching, what impact on their quality of life the condition is having. And that helps us titrate our management to ensure that we are stepping in with a new treatment at the right time, but also not changing treatments inappropriately too frequently. The other way that we have to assess patients when they come to establish whether we're getting the appropriate benefit is we do a very careful skin assessment, which provides a score. It's called the Modified Skin Surface Area Weighted Assessment. It's called an MSWOT. And what we do is we go over each part of the patient's body and establish what percentage of the skin is affected by a patch, what percentage of it is affected by a plaque, and what percentage of the skin is affected by a tumour. And that is then sort of computed, and it produces a score. And so we can have a numerical score for how the patient's skin is. We've got their symptom score about how it's impacting upon them. And of course, we have clinical photographs. So by those three sort of methods of assessment, we hope to be able to use the treatment at the appropriate time and recognise when treatments are no longer working, we need to move to something else. And I suppose in saying that, it's important that we make it clear to the patient really at the outset that we haven't got a magic treatment that will eradicate cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. Our treatments are usually to bring the disease under control, to keep it as so that it's having as little impact upon their day-to-day life as possible for as long as possible. And so it's that balance of making sure that the treatment isn't having more negative effect on them than the condition, but also ensuring that we don't let the condition, the cutaneous lymphoma, get away from itself so it's causing them too much distress.
Interesting. Now, to go back a little bit, Richard, you mentioned multidisciplinary teams, and I've certainly worked with them as a surgeon as part of an MDT. What does good look like when you've got a mix of medical specialties working together to firstly diagnose and then care for patients with these conditions?
I think good looks like having key individuals in the team, and obviously those key individuals working well together. Who are the key individuals? Dermatologists with a particular expertise in cutaneous lymphoma. So they need to be in a specialist cutaneous lymphoma service, seeing them regularly. You then need somebody with an hemato-oncology background. So an oncologist who is used to treating lymphomas and is able to be delivering some of the treatment. One treatment we haven't yet talked about is radiotherapy, which is a very important part of treatment for cutaneous lymphoma. And so you need an oncologist capable of administering radiotherapy. You need somebody, an oncologist or hematologist, with experience in delivering chemotherapy and other systemic therapies. We need the specialist histopathologist, as we discussed earlier, to help us with the diagnosis. And also, we often will carry on biopsies as the disease progresses, because sometimes that can give us insight into the future behaviour of the disease. And very importantly, we need specialist nurses who are there not only with their dermatology skills to be helping looking after the skin, but also with the more holistic support for these patients who, for as you may understand, if you think of this distress which can be enduring, there is a severe psychological burden for these patients. So it's very important that we, first of all, recognise that psychological burden and then respond to it. So specialist nurses, we have a strong psycho-oncology department with whom we work closely if we feel those patients need that sort of support. So that essentially is the team that we need in a multidisciplinary group in a specialist centre.
That's a very comprehensive approach. And you mentioned earlier about shining sunlight on the problem, treating it with light. And can you go through the range of treatments for CTCL and any similarities or differences with mycosis and Sézary? So that would be really helpful.
Yes. So if we start right at the beginning, the simplest treatment is, as I say, cream. The skin gets very dry, so emollients, and then steroid creams on a particular lesion can settle it down. Once we get more extensive, then we are recommending phototherapy, light therapy, and that can take the two forms. It can be UVB, so they just expose to UVB light in a light box, or we have a treatment called PUVA, where we ask the patients to take a photosensitizing agent called sorolin. So they take the sorolin and then go into the light box, and that gives a deeper, the light penetrates a little bit deeper so for those lesions which are a bit thicker. There are disadvantages for the patient. Then they have to wear dark glasses for periods of time after the treatment, because to protect their eyes due to this photosensitization. And there's a limit to how much phototherapy we can give. We all know that sunlight can be damaging for the skin in terms of the aging of the skin and the increased risks of skin cancers. So we've got to be mindful of the exact amount of sunlight and energy that we put into the skin, and that's carefully recorded.
I don't mean to interrupt your flow here, but you mentioned, you know, them developing skin cancers. They've effectively got a skin cancer with a lymphoma. So you're talking about developing basal cells, squamous cells, melanomas. Is that correct? And are they at increased risk with light therapy?
Absolutely right, Jonathan. So as we know, these skin cancers, basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, are quite common cancers, which usually are quite easily dealt with. Melanoma is less common, but obviously much more serious if it is allowed to develop and progress, and so it needs to be treated very early. So all these patients, if they are being treated with light therapy, it is explained to them that in later life they will be at increased risk of these sort of skin cancers, and a careful surveillance of the skin is essential. And again, in our clinics, we are always very, very careful to observe any changes in the skin which could represent one of these skin cancers, and if in doubt, they are removed.
Okay, well, thanks for that. And I'm sorry to have interrupted your flow. Please carry on. You were talking about other approaches.
So we then move to drug treatments, and there are a number of drug treatments that can be given. The retinoid family of drugs are used in a number of conditions, skin conditions, and there's one particular retinoid called bexarotene, which is in tablet form, and it can have a beneficial effect for patients who've got this extensive patch and plaque disease. Again, it can take many weeks to see the full manifestation, and it does carry with it some rather unusual side effects, in that it can increase one's cholesterol, your lipids in the blood. So patients are asked to take lipid-lowering drugs to counteract that. And it can also affect your thyroid, such that you're producing too little thyroxine, and you need to take thyroid hormone thyroxine to replace it. So it means that in addition to the tablet of bexarotene, you are taking additional tablets as well. But it can be a very beneficial treatment for bringing the disease under control for many months or even years. I think, moving on, I think what we're learning more and more is that mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome are immunoresponsive diseases, by which we mean the immune response. Our immune system plays a very important role in the control of this disease. And one immune modulator that has been around for a long time is interferon, that is given as a subcutaneous injection. Used to be given 3 times a week. We now have a long-acting one which is given once a week. And again, in a significant number of patients, they will show a benefit in reduction in the patches and the plaques, and their symptoms get better, cosmetically it gets better. And that, again, can persist for many months or even a year. But none of these are cures. They are controlling the disease. For those patients who've been through all that, then we need to move to different approaches. One approach which we should mention is radiotherapy. Now, radiotherapy, as we know, is used in a lot of cancers. One of the characteristic things about lymphoma, not just cutaneous lymphoma, but all lymphoma, is that it is exquisitely sensitive to radiotherapy, so that we can give doses of radiotherapy which are half, a quarter, even less than that, compared with the dose of radiotherapy that we might give for more common cancers such as lung cancer or head and neck cancer. So this tells us two things. One is means that the side effects of radiotherapy are very little, because the dose we only need to give is very small. And secondly, it can be done repeatedly if necessary. And when we use radiotherapy, it's usually for, if there's one area, it might be a nasty plaque where it is just starting to break down, weep, starting to stick to the clothes. It could be on the back, it could be on the arm, it could be on the trunk. But if there's one particular area which is causing distress, we can just give radiotherapy to that area, and almost universally that the disease will just melt away at that site with very little in the way of side effects. So it is a highly effective local treatment. I then emphasise local, because we do aim it at a finite area of the skin to do that. For those patients who've had light therapy, they might have had interferon, they might have had bexarotene, and they've still got quite extensive patch and plaque disease over much of their body, there is a treatment called total skin electron beam therapy, which, as the name implies, we actually stand them in front of a radiotherapy machine and aim a beam of electrons, as it turns out, and it scans the whole body. So you're trying to get the whole circle, they have to stand up in front of the machine. And if you can imagine with your arms up, you're trying to expose as much skin as you can. And we ask the patient to stand in six particular positions to ensure that we get coverage of the whole skin surface. And that treatment can be delivered over a period of between 1-2. We used to give it over 4 or 6 weeks, but now again we've learned that we can get away with much lower doses. So most treatments are given over only 1 or 2 weeks, and that can bring the disease nicely under control with relatively little in the way of side effects. If we move on beyond that to the patients who've got tumours with mycosis fungoides, then there's no alternative but to use chemotherapy. And intravenous chemotherapy can work for cutaneous lymphoma, and it can melt it away quite nicely. The very frustrating aspect of this from the patient's point of view and from our point of view is that no sooner is your back turned, no sooner as you've finished the chemotherapy, than the disease starts to come back. So you can bring the disease under control, you can reduce the tumours, reduce the distress for the patient. But once you've got it under control, you'll need to give something else to try and hold it there. Otherwise, it will come racing back. You were asking at the beginning, Jonathan, the differences between Sézary and mycosis fungoides. And in terms of treatment, there are significant differences. With Sézary syndrome, we go to maybe a mild chemotherapy tablet first off, but then there's another immune treatment that we give called extracorporeal photopheresis, ECP. What does that involve? We ask the patient to be connected to a machine, and blood is taken out of one arm, it goes into the machine and is centrifuged, and the lymphocytes are drawn off. Those lymphocytes then are exposed to light in the machine. So it's not the patient getting phototherapy now, it's just the lymphocytes getting phototherapy. The lymphocytes are then returned to the patient with the blood. And that sort of light damage to the lymphocytes sets up an immune response, which can then produce a beneficial effect in the condition. So the patients tend to have to come to have this done 2 consecutive days, every 2 weeks or every month, and they're connected to the machine for a few hours while it's being done. So it's not, you know, a simple technique. And rather like total skin electron beam therapy, ECP, extracorporeal photopheresis, is not available in routine district general hospitals. Patients will have to travel to specialist centres for both these very specialist treatments. And patients can be on ECP for many, many months. Again, it works very slowly, so we need to be monitoring them very carefully to establish, is this working, is it not? But patients can be on it for many months and even years. And it can be a way of controlling the disease but not curing it.
So, Richard, any other treatments you'd like to mention for advanced disease?
I mentioned at the beginning, Jonathan, that cutaneous lymphoma is an immune responsive disease, and there are some new immune therapies which are available. The first to mention is a drug called brentuximab, which is a monoclonal antibody which carries a toxic agent on the monoclonal antibody to target the actual malignant T lymphocytes. And this has been used in other forms of lymphoma to great effect, but has also been shown in a subset of cutaneous lymphoma. And the lymphocyte has to carry an antigen called CD30. And for those patients that carry CD30, this is the antibody to CD30, and it can prove highly effective. The other immune therapy which has come to light is a anti-CCR4 antibody called mogamulizumab. And this, as we might discuss later, has been shown to be effective in mycosis fungoides, but particularly in Sézary syndrome. And finally, in terms of immune response, some patients have gone into long-term remissions, dare we call it cure, with allogeneic stem cell transplants. And so if we can bring the disease under control with some of these agents I've just discussed, and they're in remission, and they're well enough to cope with an allogeneic, a reduced intensity allogeneic stem cell transplant, that group of patients now are holding out the possibility of a long-term remission or even cure.
Well, before we get on to the holy grail of cure, can you just briefly tell us about accurate disease staging and how does that extend beyond assessment of just the skin, but just, you know, an overview, because I do want to get onto the treatments.
Yeah. So staging of the disease is quite complex, but we have a system where we stage the skin, and it can be, if it's less than 10% of the surface area, we call it T1. If it's more than 10% of the surface area, it's T2. If the patient is developing tumours, we call that T3. And if they've got the erythroderma, that total redness of the skin, which we discussed earlier, that is T4.
That's Lom Rouge, right? The red man.
Exactly. Lom Rouge is T4.
So that, I'm taking my notes here.
So patients can be T1 to T4. We then have a nodal status because patients can develop infiltration of lymph nodes with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. The complication is here that when you examine a patient, particularly in areas, for instance, under the arm, in the axilla, and in the groin, the inguinal regions, you can come across large nodes, but only to a degree, only, shall we say, mildly large lymph glands. But those can be enlarged due to the inflammation of the skin. So people with very bad eczema can have enlarged lymph nodes. We call these dermatopathic lymph nodes, lymphadenopathy. So they've got enlarged lymph nodes, but it's not because the cutaneous lymphoma has spread into those lymph nodes. It's simply a reaction to the inflammation in the skin. And so when patients present with enlarged lymph nodes, we have to do a biopsy to establish whether it is dermatopathic or whether it is actually infiltration with cutaneous lymphoma. And finally, we also have that's the nodal staging. We then have M for metastasis. Has it affected any other organs? Has it affected the lung? Has it affected the liver? Fortunately, that is rare in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, but it can occur. And the fourth compartment for staging is the blood compartment. We mentioned at the beginning that Sézary syndrome is defined as Lom Rouge, plus there are a high number of malignant lymphocytes circulating in the blood. And these, if you did a blood film and looked at the blood film, they have a very characteristic appearance, first described by Dr. Sézary, hence the name Sézary syndrome. Rather than look at blood films now, we have the benefit of flow cytometry, so we can actually measure the different types of lymphocytes circulating in the blood from flow cytometry, and we have a classification of blood involvement from B0, B1 and B2. B2 means you have over 1,000 of these cells per volume, and that is a diagnosis of Sézary syndrome. So if you see over 1,000 cells, you have Sézary syndrome. If it's less than 250, we call that B0. And if it's between 250 and 1,000, we call that B1. What is interesting is we don't yet know the significance of B1 treatment, because some patients with quite early mycosis fungoides, only a few patches, do have some of these circulating cells that we can pick up with the very sensitive methods of flow cytometry. And we're still learning to know whether that has an impact on their future prognosis, the more cells you have at presentation. And we're taking part in a large international study called the ProClippi study, which actually has been a wonderful collaboration between colleagues in the United States, across Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Japan. And we are all offering patients the opportunity to enter one large database where we are collecting all this information. And so although it's a rare disease, when we're pulling patients in from around the world, we will be able to collect these factors at presentation, observe their natural history, and we hope to be able to develop a more accurate prognostic model. So when the patient comes through the door when we first see them and we tell them they've got mycosis fungoides and they ask what the future holds, at the moment we inevitably are rather vague because we can't predict who will stay mild and who will progress. In the years to come with these sort of studies, we hope that we will be able to offer a much more accurate prognosis for our patients and therefore manage them more appropriately.
It's a very, very thorough description, and I'm, again, certainly feeling very well educated. I do want to get on to some recent data that was presented, but first of all, can you just enumerate unmet needs for people with CTCL? And, you know, if you can just do that in like list fashion, just tell us what are the things we're currently missing?
Number one, more rapid diagnosis. We talked about that at the beginning. We've got to get the pathway quicker. We've got to, you know, we've got to highlight, you know, the public about this condition and continue to educate our health colleagues so that patients can be diagnosed sooner. I think that is a very important one. Secondly, it is to be able to relieve the symptoms in a durable way. In other words, we can bring it under control. It is keeping it under control, which I think is the unmet need at the moment. That is the constant relapsing path. And so if we can find new approaches with which mean that once we've brought it under control with our current treatments, we can maintain that remission, that would be a huge step forward. And then and I suppose linked to that is linking into long-term remission, and is there such a thing as cure, and can we cure these patients? And I suppose you asked about unmet need. If a patient was listening to this, they'd say my unmet need, if I've got terrible itching, is the relief of some of these symptoms. You know, without actually being able to control the lymphoma, the health profession is poor at managing itch, a non-specific itch. And if we could find ways of tackling the itch, that would be a huge step forward.
Thank you for that, Richard. And I'd like to move on. My final question, I'd like to consider the data that was presented at the recent European Hematology Association this year, 2021. At that congress, there was some data published on efficacy and safety of mogamulizumab and its impact on skin response, quality of life, according to patient blood tumour burden. What's the clinical relevance of study findings for this treatment?
I was fortunate enough to be involved in that clinical trial of mogamulizumab. And I think the first thing to say, it is a completely new approach to tackling cutaneous T-cell lymphoma using the immune system. And this bodes well for its efficacy even before we see the results. The second thing is that the group of patients that we were looking at, a large number of the patients in this study had Sézary syndrome. And we've talked a little bit about Sézary syndrome, but what I didn't say right at the beginning is if you look at the textbooks over the last few years or the literature over the last few years, people will quote that the median survival for a patient with Sézary syndrome is about 36 months. And so this is a very, very serious condition. And over the many years that I've been involved in cutaneous lymphoma, we've had very little in the way of effective treatments. The ECP has been probably our more effective treatment, which has held it. But beyond that, we have had very little. Mogamulizumab has demonstrated the potential to change the course of patients with Sézary syndrome and with mycosis fungoides, but probably the more dramatic aspect is with Sézary syndrome. And what that study showed was the initial study compared mogamulizumab with another drug, which we haven't talked about, which is called an HDAC inhibitor called vorinostat. And mogamulizumab, in a randomized trial, the mogamulizumab showed that the progression-free survival, so the duration of the response for the patient, was longer with mogamulizumab, and the overall response rate was longer, and the quality of life was longer for mogamulizumab versus the arm of vorinostat. What this paper, this recent paper has shown, is to start looking at those patients who receive mogamulizumab, to look at their characteristics, to see what characteristics of the patient predicted the best response to mogamulizumab. And here we found that if you had more blood involvement, and we talked about B0, B1 and B2, if you looked at patients with B2, which meant that they had a lot of circulating malignant cells, a sort of leukemic picture of Sézary syndrome, their response to mogamulizumab was better than those patients with little blood involvement. And what is so important about this is that high blood burden, B2 disease, carries a very poor prognosis. So here we've got the worst possible group of patients showing the best response. And I think across oncology, it is very rare in any disease, any cancer, to see those patients who've got the worst prognosis, the worst characteristics, to actually have the best response. So this is quite a breakthrough here for this group of patients. And we've all had the benefit of being able to use this drug on a patient access basis in recent years. And we have a number of patients who are continuing in an excellent remission. And that's not just saying that the blood has improved, but their quality of life has improved. And I have a number of patients who have had months and even years of the distress from the symptoms that we were discussing earlier, which have been alleviated and continue to be alleviated with this drug.
That's very good news, obviously, for these patients and for the physicians caring for these patients. So, Richard, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm afraid that's all we have time for. It's been fascinating to discuss CTCL with you and hear your insights from the recent Congress, the European Hematology Association 2021 Congress. And thank you for educating this particular neophyte. I'd also like to thank Kiowa Kirin for making this episode possible. And if you haven't already done so, please be sure to subscribe to the EMG Health Podcast. We have new episodes every Friday, and there are a whole bunch in the archives. So, Richard, again, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Jonathan, for inviting me.
So, folks, until next time, please stay safe, stay well, stay curious. All the best, and bye for now.